Hello and welcome to the Healthy Pregnancy Revolution. My name is Stephanie Wilson and I'm joined today with Dr. Nadia Brito Pataguana. She is a naturopathic doctor with 20 years of clinical experience in metabolic and reproductive health. For the past 6 years, Dr. Nadia has worked with the Fasting Method program as a health coach and consultant. In 2020, Nadia and Dr. Jason Fung co-wrote a book called The PCOS Plan, Prevent and Reverse Polycystic Ovary Syndrome Through Diet and Fasting. Hi, Dr. Nadia. How are you today?
Hi, Stephanie. Super excited to be here.
Awesome. So what would you share with women that you think is the most important thing they can do prior to conception to have a healthy pregnancy, a healthy baby, and a healthy postpartum?
That's a loaded question. That's a very big question. Most important thing that a woman can do preconception, right? Most important thing that a woman can do preconception. Well, to be honest, I think that the preconception time is the most important time. So I think she should do any and every single thing that she possibly can from a social point of view, physical and health point of view, emotional point of view. I think that that's a loaded question because I really do think that the preconception period is the most important. I will answer very specifically from my own sort of field, okay? From my field, I think, so not ignoring any of the other things that I just told you, right? But in my field, I think that the healthier somebody can be from a metabolic, and of course, because we now know that our hormones, right, our metabolic hormones actually have a tremendous impact on our reproductive hormones and vice versa. Our reproductive hormones have a tremendous impact. So that's, again, very, very generalized. But I think that the best that a woman can possibly be metabolically prior to conception is extremely important, not only because it's going to impact the pregnancy, so the woman during that pregnancy and her health during the pregnancy, but it turns out that it has a tremendous impact on the metabolic health of your unborn baby or babies in the future. So that might be confusing. We can get more into that. Maybe people have no idea what I mean by metabolic health, but generally, very generally, there are other expressions of metabolic syndrome, but generally we're talking, I guess, about obesity, diabetes. So there are other things in there. If we want to talk more specifically about reproductive concerns that have a metabolic sort of branch, then we're talking about some fertility concerns such as PCOS. So again, if, and this is my particular field, this is what my book is about. So young women with PCOS, which there might be a lot within your audience, Stephanie, I bet that at least 30% of the women listening to you have PCOS, have been diagnosed with PCOS, and probably a lot more have PCOS and have been undiagnosed. Okay. So it's the most common endocrine concern, so hormonal concern of young women during their reproductive years. It is probably, as I said, very likely underdiagnosed. It's definitely mistreated and disregarded. So it is a serious concern because it has all of these metabolic impacts that people sort of know, but they don't really know, you know, does obesity cause PCOS? Does PCOS cause obesity and vice versa with diabetes? You know, same thing with diabetes. Does PCOS cause diabetes? Does diabetes cause PCOS? Somehow they can see that it's related, but they don't see what the link is and often don't know what to do about it. So I think from my experience, because it affects so many women, the most important thing I think is to actually reverse PCOS and reverse any and all signs, if possible, of metabolic syndrome. And that might sound impossible to some, or some might say PCOS is a genetic condition that cannot be reversed. Well, in fact, it can be if you understand the root cause of PCOS. Okay. So that would be, if possible. I know most people, you know, nowadays, most people, when they want to get pregnant, they want to get pregnant yesterday. No, that's not how it used to be, but that's how it is nowadays, right? When women decide or families decide that they want to have a baby, they want to get pregnant yesterday. So it's hard. And so it sounds real hard to have somebody say to you, you know, now you got to reverse all your metabolic syndrome expressions, such as, you know, if you're overweight, now you got to try to lose all that weight. if you have PCOS, which is such a complicated, multifactorial, you know, challenging condition. People are thinking, what, how am I ever? I've had that since I was 13 years old. You know, but my experience has shown me that the healthier you are metabolically before pregnancy, the healthier you're going to be and easier pregnancy you're going to have, and the better the metabolic health of your children are going to be, which is extremely important, right? Because now we're having babies, kids with obesity, diabetes, and it's again, multifactorial concerns, but one of the, you know, really important factors is the health of the mother during pregnancy and preconception. So that's, again, I could go on, but let me know what you think about that, Stephanie.
Yeah. So you're saying about PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, for all of the women that we believe likely have it and don't know, how can they get tested? How can they know? Is there something they should request from their doctor?
Well, PCOS is very well known within, very well recognized within conventional medicine. It's not well, I don't think it's, as I said, I don't think it's being treated appropriately. However, it is not an unknown condition. It's the most common condition. So most women don't really have to ask their doctors. However, and you also don't really need a diagnosis. This is the big, big thing that I tell people. Wow. Because, you know, what is the diagnosis going to give you, right? What is having that diagnosis going to give you? You're going to have a doctor who's going to do their very best because they're well-intentioned. And they're going to say, well, if you're not trying to get pregnant, you take a pill to manage your symptoms. And if you're trying to get pregnant, do some fertility treatment. So why do you need the diagnosis, right? There is no treatment for PCOS within the conventional medical community. So I don't think that you need the diagnosis, but you can easily look this up. You know, what is PCOS? Right? How do you get diagnosed with PCOS? What can you ask your doctor? Very easy. It's a syndrome. So it's a collection of symptoms. Not everybody has the exact same symptoms. You're somewhere on that spectrum, right? There are four possibly phenotypes of PCOS. I had the frank type of PCOS, meaning the most severe form, the one that had all three of the diagnostic criteria, but you can be diagnosed with two out of the three. But it is a syndrome of, it's a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that you only get diagnosed with PCOS if you can rule out all these other seemingly more serious conditions, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, is this condition that affects a lot of organs, right? It has a lot of expressions. The most prominent ones, of course, are irregular menstrual cycle and or ovulation. So you can have a period and not ovulate and vice versa, right? So irregular, meaning you get it sometimes you don't get it. Some women might not get a period and may not ovulate for months on end. Some just skip a few here and there, right? So it's not the same for everybody. It's also abnormal, so hyper high levels of male hormones, so androgens, right, including testosterone. So it's not just high levels of testosterone on lab. Your lab levels might be normal. Why? Because the range is big, number one, and it varies throughout the day and throughout your cycle. Mm-hmm. So that might not be that actually isn't the diagnostic criteria. The diagnostic criteria is expression of excessive male hormones. So what does that mean? Excessive acne, excessive male pattern hair growth on your face, on your body. And you've seen extreme cases of this, right? And then male pattern baldness. So again, it's not that PCOS is the only condition that causes this, but this is one of the three diagnostic criteria. And the third is many cysts on ultrasound. So in the ovaries, polycysts, poly means many, many cysts. In fact, they're not really cysts. They're these fluid filled sacs. They're all the follicles that didn't mature and didn't make it to ovulation. So it's actually, they look like cysts. It's like this pearl necklace sort of formation on the ovaries, very easily seen. You can have polycysts on your ovaries and not have PCOS. So many women, normal, you know, quote unquote normal, have cysts and they don't have PCOS. So again, to be diagnosed with PCOS, you have to have two out of these three diagnostic criteria. So cysts with excessive male hormones, or cysts with irregular ovulation and menstruation, or two out of three, you know, of the other way. And that's how you have these different phenotypes, the different expressions. If you have all three, and again, diagnosis of exclusion, so all three, and you've excluded other conditions, then you have what's called the frank type of PCOS, or the more severe form. And that's the type that I had. So here's what possibly might be confusing for women listening to me today, is that nowhere in there in the diagnostic criteria did we talk about diabetes or obesity, right? So women are saying, well, why am I dealing with the metabolic part when this is these are the expressions that I'm concerned about? So what do women do, and what does conventional medicine do when you have these very debilitating expressions, right? They try to treat the symptom instead of treating the root cause. So if your symptom is irregular menstruation and or ovulation, you're put on birth control pill, right? If your symptom is excessive male hair and acne, often you're put on certain medications that lower testosterone, right? And the same thing goes for the polycysts, even though that's not a symptom that women often see, right? So the conventional treatment now for PCOS is sort of a band-aid, as Dr. Fung would say in our book, over a bullet hole, right? They're just treating it superficially. They're trying to treat or manage the symptoms, right? So if you take the pill like I did, like many young women do for about 10 years, you keep these symptoms sort of masked, but the underlying condition is still there. So then later on in life, when you do try to conceive, right, and you get off the pill, then all of this comes up again, and then you don't have a solution for that problem. So then what's the solution? Then the conventional treatment for the infertility that might come is fertility treatments. And sort of that's the route that most women go on. Associated with this, there's a lot of other expressions and conditions, but they're not under the diagnostic criteria, meaning you don't have to have any of these to be diagnosed, but we know that they are associated, such as obesity, primarily central obesity, meaning fat around your belly, more so than overall obesity, although both are prevalent, right? Diabetes or pre-diabetes, or you know, trouble with blood sugar control, and all the other really, I think now we know, expressions of metabolic syndrome, because metabolic syndrome is associated with this highly reproductive concern and vice versa. Okay. Here's the thing. Many, many women do not have PCOS or have not been diagnosed with PCOS, yet they still have metabolic syndrome expressions, such as obesity and diabetes or pre-diabetes, and or, you know, one or the other or both, and have reproductive concerns. So for example, you can be a young woman who's got either obesity or blood sugar control issues. And sometimes your blood sugars are still normal, but you notice that your blood sugar doesn't feel right, either because of the way, like the way that you react after you eat, before you eat, you know, blood sugar feels high, feels low. You crave sugars, you know, that sort of thing. That's what happened to me. I had rebound hypoglycemia before I was diagnosed with pre-diabetes and eventually diabetes, meaning the only thing I noticed was low blood sugars every time I ate, or after I ate, or when I wasn't eating. So the impression was that I just needed to keep eating more and needed to keep eating more sugar. But really I was feeding that developing metabolic syndrome. So eventually I developed pre-diabetes and then eventually diabetes. And this was all related to PCOS. Mm-hmm. So you may not have the PCOS diagnosis, but you may have some reproductive concerns, right? Things like irregular menstruation, irregular period, or, you know, been trying to conceive for a very long time and you haven't succeeded, have not been diagnosed with PCOS, or maybe the doctor has ruled out PCOS, yet they still are having some trouble with fertility. So they've been trying to conceive for a long time, for over a year. That's usually where you become concerned, and the doctor might diagnose you with some type of infertility concern, and that infertility may still be associated with metabolic syndrome, or as we call it, insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. Right? Within our program, we talk a lot about insulin resistance. So we know that just like PCOS, so PCOS is a syndrome on a spectrum. You can have different expressions, and you can have a more severe form or more or a less severe form. We also know that the same thing happens with people with metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance. You can be on the very tip of the spectrum of insulin resistance and have very, very severe, which means you have all these expressions of obesity, PCOS, diabetes, hypertension, fatty liver, et cetera, et cetera. Or you could just be somewhere on the spectrum, you know, where you may have a little bit. So we know that now that we understand PCOS and that it's a reproductive concern with a lot of metabolic syndrome expressions, right? Now we know that actually insulin resistance has a huge impact on your reproductive health, meaning that you may not have PCOS. So meaning that if you have some insulin resistance, you may also, depending on where you are on that spectrum, you may also start to develop some reproductive concerns. And this makes a lot of sense because our hormones are messengers, right? Mm-hmm. So insulin is an endocrine, known, mostly recognized as a metabolic hormone, right? That regulates blood sugars. And now we understand that it regulates fat storage and whatnot, right? And my colleague and co-author, Dr. Jason Fung, has written other books. He wrote The Obesity Code that explains insulin's role in obesity very, very well. And he wrote The Diabetes Code, which it explains the role of insulin in diabetes very, very well. But now that we understand PCOS, we understand that insulin has a major function on our reproductive health. And this, as I was saying, is even though insulin is mostly recognized as a metabolic hormone, we know that it has some reproductive functions as well, or it has an impact on our reproductive hormones. And this makes a lot of sense because hormones are messengers, right? They work in this lock and key sort of function. And that means that, you know, they go into the body, into the receptors on the cells, right? The hormone is like the key and the receptors on the cells are like the lock. And if the right key goes into the right lock and you turn it, you know, it opens a door. Basically, it's a messenger that if it goes into the right receptor, it gives a message, and then your body functions in response to that message, right? Like it obeys the order kind of thing. So they're messengers, and they're really not independent of each other. So they communicate with each other. So if one hormone is off, it makes sense that other hormones would be off too. Mm-hmm. So if insulin is off, we now know that and we understand it very well, specifically when it comes to PCOS, why that would have an impact on your other glands that produce other hormones. So other glands such as your ovaries, right, that produce your reproductive hormones, et cetera, et cetera. So this all going back to your original question of what would you do, right? What can you do? We don't have, we don't have a lot of control, direct control over certain hormones such as estrogen, testosterone. It isn't like eat more of this, eat less of that. At least I don't believe that it is. Some people will say, you know, seeds this and those seeds that. I'm not a big believer in that. Although I do think that, of course, all foods have some impact. But what we have an immense amount of control over, even though we may not recognize it, we have an immense amount of control over how much insulin we produce, depending on what we eat and how we eat.
Which leads us right into your fasting method. I would love to hear about how can that improve our insulin resistance? How can that affect us in pregnancy and preconception? What can women do with fasting? And let me add to that, not to make this a super long question, but I personally have heard a lot about fasting not being good for women's hormonal health. So could you address that? And that?
Absolutely. It's a big question. I mean, we could have just one entire summit on this, to be honest. I know that there is a lot, and this to me is very, very important because I mostly work with women. I work with men as well, but mostly work with women and have for the last 20 years. Most women come to me because of metabolic syndrome concerns such as obesity, diabetes, and now fertility. So it's a big, really big pet peeve of mine. It really hurts my heart, to be totally honest, when I hear, you know, quote unquote experts say that fasting is bad for women because, quote unquote, it is bad for their hormones. Okay. And I have a whole bunch of lectures on this and presentations on this. And because, first of all, that's a very big statement. Okay. Because women have are very complex. And we have hundreds of hormones. So when you say that fasting is bad for women because it is bad for your hormones, which hormones exactly are you talking about? Because unless you're going to talk about a specific hormone or a few of them, then right away, that bothers me quite a bit. Second of all, how many people out there can confidently say that they have seen or worked with a sufficient amount of women to actually say that, or to say that there is enough research out there to prove that fasting is bad for women? How many people are actually out there that actually have the experience that it would be required to actually say something like that? And so most of the time when we work with people, we're working with intermittent fasting. We do have a branch of protocols that we call therapeutic fasting, okay, or healing fast, which are longer and usually done with more supervision, okay, particularly medical supervision for some. But most of our patients, when we were in clinic, and now that we're mostly online, most of our clients are doing intermittent fasting. So various amounts of, there's a whole array of options of different schedules, but right. Intermittent means, eat, stop, eat, stop, eat, stop. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of TRE, time restricted eating, which is what I mostly teach people and focus on. But okay. What I would love for women to consider is that, I always joke that the journey is long, so long as we shall live. And I really hope that all of us have a long, healthy, in happy life. That would be the ideal situation, that you are happy, healthy, fulfilled, that you have a whole lot of children if that's what you want. And but to be honest, my grandmother had 5, I think Queen Elizabeth had 4, but to be honest, the majority of your life is outside of pregnancy and breastfeeding. So take that time to work on that. Mm-hmm. And while you're pregnant and breastfeeding, that is the time to focus on growing this precious baby, right? So it obviously makes sense that you would focus on eating really well and focus on really healthy foods during that time and leave the fasting for every other time. And that is why I so highly recommend that women, particularly the people that I work with, right? People that come to me know that they're going to be doing some fasting because I work for the fasting method, and have for a very long time. So, if you're coming to work with me, at least 3 months before conception, that's a really good period of time for us to do some, intermittent fasting and even some therapeutic fast. So if you've got 3 months till you want to get pregnant, it's a really good time for us to look at some therapeutic fasting if we wanted to. We can do some serious healing in that time, including for people with PCOS and other expressions of metabolic syndrome, such as obesity and diabetes, okay? Women with diabetes, for example, or pre-diabetes or at risk for diabetes are much more likely to have gestational diabetes when they're pregnant, of course. Mm-hmm. And just that whole hyperinsulinemic state during pregnancy, so high levels of insulin during pregnancy, there's a tremendous high risk for pregnancy complications and a very likely risk for babies who develop metabolic syndrome very early in life. So obesity, diabetes, et cetera. Okay, so I would love if people had the opportunity and had the information. But to go back to your question about experts saying that fasting is particularly bad for women and particularly bad for hormones, I mean, these are the two things I'd like people to really highly consider, right? And when they say it's bad for women because it's bad for your hormones, I'd like you to become informed and just find out how many different hormones we have in our body. And there are hundreds and hundreds. So is fasting bad for every hormone? Is fasting bad for just one hormone? A couple of hormones? What is fasting actually bad for? Okay. And remember that people fast and have fasted since the beginning of time and continue to fast every single religion and, for a whole bunch. So if that's really true, then let's look into that a little bit. And secondly, right, if a professional is telling you, or you're hearing this, because we have to be advocates for our own health, right? So if a professional is telling you that fasting is bad for women, you want to find out sort of how much experience this person has with fasting people, how many of his or her patients they have actually followed and tested that have been fasting in order to say that. And really, you want to look at, are there really enough proper, you know, even research to back this statement up. And there isn't, right? There's never been much interest in fasting and research. And any research that you find is probably done on animals, or it's done, you know, or it's done on a small group of people. And then when you go and read the article, it's not really fasting that they're doing. It's more of a starvation type of plan. So they have some calories. It's not no calories. Mm-hmm. You know, people are doing juicing, or they're doing, you know, or they've studied people that have been in famine type states where they've been eating very, very little. But that is not the same as fasting. Most right. people that do intermittent fasting are doing an intermittent type of fast where they eat and then they fast and they eat and they fast. Mm-hmm. Even people that are doing more extended fasts on their eating days, they're having an adequate amount of fat, an adequate amount of protein, at least if they're being followed up, right? So when I say to you, and I say this not humbly, I know it's not going to sound humble at all, but when I say to you that I don't know that there are, outside of our fasting method program led by Dr. Jason Fung, Megan Ramos, and myself and the rest of our team, that we have been doing this. Jason Fung and Megan Ramos have been doing this for over 10 years in clinic with actual, you know, we've done case studies and we have thousands upon thousands of clinical evidence. And our greatest number of patients and clients are women. Hmm. So, you know, if you're going to listen to the experts on this particular topic, then you must go to the experts on this particular topic. And you have to make sure that if you're going to recommend fasting or not recommend fasting, that we're talking about fasting, intermittent fasting.
Right.
And not something else.
You're right. Cause it is easily confused with, like I just mentioned, a juice fast, and that's not the fasting that you're referring to. You're still consuming.
It isn't at all. And there's many other types of programs out there that call themselves fast mimicking type of programs. Mm-hmm. And that's not fasting either. Mm-hmm. Right. And our program does have a double component. We do teach people how to do intermittent fasting, as well as, you know, a very focus on real food type of diet, which isn't necessarily exclusive of any diet. We have people that are vegan. We have people that are carnivore. We have people that are omnivore. We have loads of people that are low carb, but some that aren't. And so it's really a combination of eating real food. And what does that mean? It means avoiding junk and processed food. It's not a specific low carb program or any other program. It's not a high fat program either. It can be for some individuals if that's the diet that they choose to be on. But what it is specifically a real food, appropriate fat, appropriate protein for each individual. Right. So it's very, very individualized in that sense. And then, of course, the fasting protocols as well. And it's, as I said, I'm repeating myself, but I'm a big fan of repetition. It's really, really, really important that we become our own advocates of our health. So our medical doctors, our coaches, and everybody else, they are our consultants, right? They're giving us a service. We're paying them for a service, whether it's through your insurance or through your own pocket. So you want to really, you really do need to, at this point, become aware, become informed, and really go to the right people for the right things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is extremely informative for myself as well as everyone listening. So that leads right into, I know you've touched on it, but how important is it that a woman is at a healthy weight on both ends of the spectrum, not too small and not too large going into a pregnancy, and how that's going to affect both the pregnancy for 9 months and labor delivery?
That's a great question. So weight in and of itself, pounds are actually not as important as people think that they are. What's most important, and this is where we'll get into a little bit more detail, is your metabolic health. So what does that mean, right? Of course, again, we're talking about hormones. You want your hormones to be at their optimal level. And sometimes it's really hard to test this conventionally, right? So you have to, again, become your own advocate. You have to become a little bit more informed. But weight is often an expression of your hormonal environment. And so you want to look at different things. Number one, you want to understand body composition a little bit better than weight. So it isn't necessarily about how much you weigh, but maybe it's more about how much total body fat you have, how much visceral fat. Now, this is the important one. So that's the fat around your organs. It's called viscera or visceral fat. Okay. And of course, you can do this professionally. You can get a really good body composition scale at home, and you can start to learn about this, and you can do some research and again, go to the experts and find out what's a really good body composition. And you really do want to be, have a really good body composition, particularly as a young woman trying to conceive. You want to make sure that you have a good body composition, but most importantly, it's the central obesity. It's the fat around the belly. And sometimes you can't see it on the outside. I was one of those people that I actually had a lot of fat. I was very thin myself, and I'm still thin. I did gain a lot of weight in between that point. I did gain a lot of weight between the point that I developed PCOS. And then once I started to figure this out, even for myself, that was many years ago, but in there, my most prominent and sometimes not obvious sign was a lot of fat around my organs. So for myself, I was small, I was thin. So if I were only focused on weight, I would have missed that. In fact, my doctor was only focused on weight, and because he was so overly focused on my weight, he completely disregarded me, didn't want to diagnose me with PCOS until I came in with sort of evidence. This was many years ago before I had my first child, who's now 12, you know, and I had to be the one coming in again, informed, being an advocate for my own health, saying, I am certain that I have this condition because of ABCD. You know, I had the Frank type, as I said, but yet based on my weight, he disregarded me. And in fact, he tried doing this on my belly, on my skin, pulling up my skin around my belly and saying, you have no fat, but he was pulling up my subcutaneous fat. He wasn't looking at the fat around my organs. And it turned out that I did have a high percentage of body of organ fat, visceral fat, and fatty liver, of course, which means the same exact same thing. And that was what was causing. And at that time, I already had other expressions. I was already suffering with slightly higher than normal blood pressure and slightly higher than normal blood sugars. And this is very common in some people because genetically, you might be more prone towards obesity, whereas other people genetically might be more prone towards central obesity. And that was my case. For me to gain a significant amount of weight that you can actually see from the outside, at that point, I already have a lot of organ fat and I already have a lot of other expressions. You know, the PCOS was big for me. I had hypertension, diabetes, you know, and other concerns before I even became overweight. So it's the organ fat that you want to look at. So I would think that that's focus more on that than you do on the actual weight per se, the pounds. Athletes, a lot of women that are more athletic, more muscular are going to weigh a lot more, and yet they're going to be a lot healthier. Right. So it's the organ fat that we want to look at. Okay. Because that is going to increase your risk of every single expression of metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. So if you have more organ fat, you're going to be a lot more prone towards having diabetes, you know, and other expressions of metabolic syndrome, including fertility concerns.
Wow. That's an extraordinary story. I really appreciate you sharing that, because I think a lot of women can relate to that difference between your weight and, but yet you're thin and it still could be an issue for you.
That's right.
So are there any certain toxins that you think that women should focus on getting tested for or detoxing their body for prior to conception?
You know, I think this is a big topic within my profession, the naturopathic. I was trained as a naturopathic doctor 20 years ago. And so I think that this is a big topic within my profession. However, just because of the way where life took me, I didn't go down that path. Didn't go down that route. So I actually was never one to, I don't have a lot of experience in that particular realm of things. I focus a lot more on hormones because I think, you know, hormones are speaking to our body all the time. I of course know that there are toxins, you know, the more toxins you're exposed to, you're going to be at a higher risk of everything. And toxins are definitely hormonal disruptors. So absolutely. But again, if you want to talk about toxins, make sure that you go to the experts. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're concerned about toxins, make sure that you go to the experts, you know, and, you know, it wouldn't be Nadia that you would go to ask for that.
So in relation to hormones, I like looking at my days as a cycle of my bedtime routine starts from the time I wake up. I want to get into the bright sun. I want to get my melatonin, everything. It starts my bedtime. You understand that at the from the moment I wake up the day before. So
I understand that so much more than what you might think. But yes, I'm loving it so far. Go on.
Well, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. But I was going to relate that to kind of the same cycle with obviously our hormones are what's going to cause the contractions and have a healthy delivery at the end of pregnancy. Is there anything a woman can do focusing on hormones and doing everything the right way, even in this conception period, to affect her postpartum period?
Okay. So I'm going to go back to your example, your analogy, because I think this is an amazing one, and it ties really nicely into what we were talking about before. All hormones are messengers, and all hormones communicate with one another. So if something is off, everything else is off. And again, we're very hormonally blessed and complicated. So there are a ton of hormones that we are, you know, of course, bathed in, but because of my particular area of expertise, I have something that I call my five pillars. Okay. And my five pillars to health, not my five pillars to losing weight, not my five pillars to diabetes, not even my five pillars to fertility, because it's my five pillars to health. And if you look at all the things I talked about today, obesity, diabetes, fertility, you see how they're all so intricately connected, even though we didn't realize that they were before. But they're connected because of one particular hormone, which is insulin, which is a hormone that we know how to control. Okay. Unlike other ones that we may not know how to control, we know how to control insulin because when we eat, no matter what we eat, whether it's healthy or unhealthy, high calorie, low carb, high carb, every single time that we eat, our body produces insulin. It has to. Okay. It's necessary. And insulin is not a bad hormone. It's just too much of insulin, just like too much of most things is not a good thing, right? So every single time that we eat, we produce insulin. It's important to understand this. Before I go on to my next topic, but every time that we eat, insulin goes up. And when we stop eating, insulin starts to slowly go back down. And so you want to have, like every other hormone is pulsatile, right? Your body produces and it stops and it produces and it stops based on other messages and whatnot. So you want to be able, and so knowing that we can control this particular hormone, you want to be able to control it in that pulsatile type of manner. That's where the intermittent fasting sort of comes in. So you eat and stop and eat and stop. Unfortunately, nowadays, people, because of the kind of foods that we eat and the way that we're eating, we sort of are eating nonstop, right? We're not allowing that adequate amount of time between meals for that insulin to drop. And that's why people develop insulin resistance. They're producing too much insulin too often because they're eating highly processed foods that produce way more insulin than any real food. And they're eating much more often than they should. So instead of eating full meals, they're eating a whole lot of snacks all day long and, you know, putting things in their coffee, putting things in their water, drinking things that produce an insulin response all day long. So they're producing a lot of insulin and constantly, and that leads to insulin resistance and all the expressions that we talked about today, right? Including the central obesity, general obesity, diabetes, PCOS, et cetera, et cetera. So based on that and knowing how important of a hormone insulin is and that we can actually control it, right? There's my husband has this tattooed on his body. I should know. It's the prayer, not prayer. Okay, so I'm going to read to you the serenity prayer. It says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And this reminds me a lot of insulin and other hormones. There's a lot of hormones that we don't know if we can control or not, or how to control them, but that there are others that we can. And we really need the know-how. We need the knowledge and information and support and the courage, right? That we have to make that decision. Okay, so now we recognize this is a hormone I can control. Okay. And it is such a powerful hormone and it communicates with probably every single other hormone in our body. Okay. So if we know that, that's what my five pillars are based on. And I'm telling you all of this because you mentioned sleep, funny enough. So the first pillar for me, most important, is learning how to eat. So remember, I was talking about the eat, stop. So how often you eat is the first pillar for me. Okay. Because that is going to be the one that's going to have the most impact on your insulin production. Okay. So if you're struggling with hyperinsulinemia, too much insulin, insulin resistance, and all these other expressions, the solution is to lower insulin. So how do we do that? And we do that, why? Because either we want to lose weight, or we want to burn belly fat, or we want to lower blood sugars, or we want to get pregnant and we have some fertility concerns, or whatever it is, right? Many other reasons, you know, mental clarity or something else. So how often you eat, what time you eat. This is another big topic, because your insulin production is actually based on a circadian rhythm, day, night cycle. You were talking about, you know, first thing in the morning and all day long, understanding that most of our hormones are based on a circadian rhythm, right? Most things are based on a circadian rhythm, day, night cycle. They react differently during sunlight than they do during the nighttime. The third thing is what you eat, right? Because as we've talked about before, certain foods are going to produce a lot more insulin. Other foods are going to produce a lot less insulin. And then four and five is stress and sleep management. I'm not saying that you're going to eliminate stress, but you have to learn how to control your internal stress hormones. And there are many, many, many cortisol lowering techniques that you can learn and that you can do each and every single day, including different types of exercise or movement and many other things. And then the fifth pillar, and super important, so highly disregarded, is sleep. And sleep and stress are not independent of each other. They're connected, because if you don't sleep properly, if you don't have enough sleep, enough good quality sleep, your body is going to produce a lot more stress hormones. And the higher your stress hormones are, the higher your insulin production is going to be. It's important that we realize that, again, all these hormones communicate with each other. So if you don't have your sleep in check, and if you don't have your stress control in check, then you're going to have a much, much higher incidence and chance of having all the different metabolic syndrome conditions that we just talked about. So stress and sleep. I am married to a man who doesn't believe that he needs to sleep, because he functions just fine. He's in a good mood, which is annoying. No matter how well he sleeps, how little he sleeps, once he's up, he's at it, and he's, you know, type A and whatnot. I'm somebody who, if I don't sleep well, you can see it in my mood, you can see it in everything. So for me, it's like, oh, sleep is so important. For him, it's like, sleep is not important, but it is so important. And over the years, because I've worked with so many people with diabetes, I have been able to see this. If somebody with diabetes does not sleep well, their blood sugars the next day are much, much, much higher. If they're not just a little higher, and if you ask diabetics, they'll tell you this. And so we must learn from them. We must realize this doesn't just happen to diabetics. It's just that they can see it and we cannot. So my husband is one of these people that's always struggled with his weight his entire life. And finally, after many, many years and knowing this, he has finally learned to understand that unless he can control his sleep, then he cannot control his weight. And this is the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. Okay. So sleep is super important. And how do you sleep better? You do it by learning about sleep and realizing, just like you said, that if you're going to sleep well at night, it has to start in the morning. For you to sleep well at night, you have to get enough sun. For you to sleep well at night, you have to get enough sunlight in the morning. Isn't that funny? Like, the opposites are so important, and many, many, many other things. I mean, I'm no sleep expert. I'm very interested in this topic because of how much it impacts metabolic health, which to me is my topic of interest, but sleep is huge. So I forget what your question was.
If there's anything that we can do preconception, the way that we similarly can before, way before bedtime, is there anything we could do way before labor and delivery that could improve our experience through labor and delivery?
Well, if I can leave my five pillars with you, then I will. Mm-hmm. Okay. So looking at how often you eat, what time you eat, what you eat, stress management, and sleep. Okay. And
that's gonna always balance hormones. Yep.
That is going to balance your hormones so much, because it basically encompasses most things that we can control. Okay. Mm-hmm. And sleep, as again, it's a big topic. So it's not just getting enough daylight. I think that we have come to this day and age where we want everything to be a quick fix. No quick fixes here. Okay. For sleep, you have to really understand, but it does start first thing in the morning. Okay. Some movement, getting early morning sunshine, managing, you know, blue light. There's a whole lot of stuff. And when it comes to stress management, the exact same thing. Again, you're probably not going to change jobs. You're probably not going to change husbands or whoever is stressing you out, but you are in control of a little bit anyway. And that's, again, the serenity prayer. We're going to have the courage to control the things that we can. And what we can do is implement some, and it's not one every once in a while, it's, you know, a few cortisol lowering techniques each and every day. And most things take a couple of minutes, right? People ask me about exercise all the time. I'm also not an exercise expert, but I believe movement, of course, who doesn't? I believe movement is extremely important. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly important for helping to manage stress and sleep. However, you do have to, again, go to the right experts, realize that particularly people that have adrenal concerns, so stress management concerns, women with PCOS are a big group, may not always do well with high intensity exercise because it often adds a little bit of too much fuel to that fire. So doing some different types of exercises, different type of movement can actually be a lot more beneficial for those type of women. I also wouldn't overfocus on exercise for weight loss because as Dr. Fung would say, that's, you know, when it comes to weight loss, diet is really the Batman and exercise is more Robin. And so it's necessary, it's important, but it's not like the more exercise you do, the more intense it is, the more success you're going to have in weight loss. It doesn't work that way. The main hormone behind that doesn't respond that way. Okay. So it's insulin that you want to lower if you're dealing with weight. Okay.
Well, that has been extremely informative. I know for myself personally, you've cleared up a lot of misconceptions I had around all of these things, insulin and weight and PCOS. I appreciate you so much for sharing all of that today.
My pleasure.
So you're giving or sharing with our audience chapter 7 of your book, The PCOS Plan, where women can learn and go even deeper into this. Is that right?
That is right. I actually have it right here because I don't even remember what chapter 7 was anymore. And I asked our editors and publishers if they would give a gift to your summit. And so chapter 7, you'll probably have it in front of you. Chapter 7 says, well, that's good. Insulin, polycystic ovaries, and ovulation. So it really does hopefully explain to people a little bit of the connection between insulin, this hormone that I've been talking about this whole time, and how that impacts your reproductive cycles and ovulation. So I hope you enjoy it.
Awesome. And we've got a link to that directly below this audio you're listening to there. Thank you so much, Dr. Nadia, for joining us today.
My pleasure.